Grandpa's Blue Memo. It's late November, 1923, and Grandpa is in a crisis of faith. Here's the background. He'd had misgivings about allowing Ronald to attend a North Shore private university instead of the Ag School at Wisconsin, where he'd first been enrolled, and those misgivings seemed justified. The fraternity is Ronald's main interest. Grandpa writes him in his sophomore year, "I am sorry you are not able to retrench in the useless and harmful and wasteful expenses. If you realized that it meant quitting school, if you cannot get on without these flowers and parties and eat and dance times, you would think twice before following the crowd." By his junior year, Ronald is earning much of his own money, but at what cost? His grades are undistinguished. He has no idea of what he wants to do with his life. He shows little interest in attending church. And a year ago, he was with 40 other Northwestern boys, were carted off to jail in a raid on a bohemian speakeasy named the Wind Blew Inn. Grandpa had to pay the stiff fine and appear in court with all the other fathers and sons. The newspapers, even out-of-state ones, made hay of the story, with many puns on how the police blew in and blew out again with all the college youth in their paddy wagons. Ronald's name, usually misspelled, was in all the Chicago papers, but kind Providence omitted it from the front page right up in the Beloit Daily News. Grandma writes to her son, "When we saw this in the Beloit paper, our hearts stood still till we had read it through, fearing your name would be in it." And a month later, he's caught smoking. His mother writes, "I asked Papa if you had smoked any since you went back, and he had to tell the truth. I cannot see how you can do it. Your father has done so much for you and loves you so, and you know how he has always despised the habit and felt men were so much smaller who do it. I should think you would want to tower up in his eyes and do nothing that would keep him from admiring you in every way. The dear, unselfish, wonderful dad. He is carrying such a heavy load and practically all alone. He cannot keep that beautiful, optimistic spirit up against everything. He told me so long as he could keep his grit, he could make it go. But if he loses that, it's all up with him. Ronald, you must be his support. He is the best friend you have on earth, and you must keep his love and respect. Oh, my precious boy, if I could know, you would stand firm against the cigarette or any smoking, I would be the happiest woman on earth. Papa and I would rather have that assurance and have you stand firm from principle than have the grandest home money could buy." So far, Ronald's college career has not made his father happy, especially when he thinks back to how hard he himself struggled to put himself through school to get a solid education. But there are other factors. There's a mini depression in the early 20s, and Grandpa is sick with financial worries. "I must pay taxes this month and many other bills. I will be $1,500 behind on meeting running expenses and necessary bills the last of this month." He's upset about his help. They're not of the caliber he's used to. They come and they leave. And then there is Grandma. She's suffering from some nervous malady, has insomnia, is dizzy, spends weeks down at Aunt Ida's or in Chicago at the home of friends. Even when she's at home, she spends much of her time resting on the couch. Grandpa is in charge, with the help of the hired woman, Hilda, extra hired help, and Esther, now 14, He's glum about the state of the house. He finds it hard to be in charge of everything. When Ronald, 20 and a restless first semester junior, thinks about dropping out of school and working for a while, his father is quick to offer him a job. "If you decide to do this, I will start you in the barn as assistant herdsman. You help do the work in the morning, then study, and check up records in the PM. After about 2 weeks of this, you will be familiar with the herd, hardened to physical work, so I can put the other assistant to other work. In April, I will want to take you out of the barn and put you onto the farm, helping to prepare the field and put in the crop. By next winter, you will be able to assume some management. I do not want to think of ending your schooling, but to plan to return after a year or so to your studies, and with a definite aim, and then take the highest training in your chosen line. Ronald's decision is to stay in school for the second term. And then the offer to do social work in a war-ravaged French town comes through, and he takes it, departing before the semester is finished, and leaving his low grades to show up at the farm after he's out of the country. That summer, Grandpa doesn't have his elder son's help on the farm, nor his younger son's either, for Trevor, instead of working shoulder to shoulder with his father, as Wesson had happily anticipated, takes a job selling fly spray. Ronald's letters from France are filled with the exuberance of youth. A young man having his eyes suddenly opened to the wide world and being dazzled. Trevor goes off to a Wisconsin, joins the UW chapter of Ronald's fraternity, acquires a car. Grandpa writes, "Regarding your car, you are better off without it, even if it costs nothing. What you need to develop quiet strength and poise of mind and character. The car tends to develop just the opposite qualities. Walk and think and grow great. I do not want you to use a car in Madison. Sell out and walk." Trevor is happy-go-lucky. Unlike his brother, doesn't bother to earn money. Grandpa's letters to him have a three-note monotony. Tend to your studies. Don't spend so much so frivolously. Lead a pure, manly life. Concerning the budget Trevor sends home in the fall, Grandpa writes wryly, "Your financial statement was ambiguous. Whether you need $25 for these purchases in future, or whether you have spent this and more, I cannot make out. I notice you are not planning to eat for a month." Grandpa is also discouraged about his hearing. He writes again to Trevor, how those he takes along to write for him either think the talks are not worthwhile, lose interest, and cease to write, "you and mother of late," or become so intensely interested themselves that they forget him, Henry and Lester. And when he gives talks and speeches, he finds the communication with his hosts and audiences increasingly difficult. So, in late November 1923, Grandpa sits down at his desk and, in a letter to himself, written in pencil on scratch paper, takes stock of his life. "These have been my ideals: to build a successful business that would give opportunity for life as well as a living, to build a home that would be a model for convenience and beauty and a desirable place to live, to inspire my family and entire household with high ideals and give them a happy life, to live a straightforward Christian life, to continue to grow mentally and morally, to be active in work and religious work, to have our home distinctively Christian, to so direct and inspire my children that they would choose the good and detest the evil. Regarding my feeling as to my failure in realizing these ideals, we have worked hard and developed a successful business and built a house, but by its own burden, it is destined to fail in its ultimate aim. We have no pleasure in it now. It is not a desirable place to live. We take no pleasure in the work or the life. There are many reasons for this: failing health, unsatisfactory help, necessity of economy in order to meet obligations, and especially the lack of interest on the part of our lads. In the latter part of this ideal, I have failed. The very things I have provided for making my family happy have caused discontent and unhappiness. I have given leisure and opportunity for camp and recreation, and this has created a restlessness and dissatisfaction with real life. In all but the first clause, I feel I am falling down. Our home is becoming just an ordinary non-Christian farmhouse. My church and religious work is of no account. To keep the mind alert and conscious sensitive seems difficult. Even in the personal Christian faith and practice, I am failing far short of the example of the Master. He had courage to undertake the difficult. He had perseverance. He had hope. He was confident of ultimate victory. He knew what he believed. I don't. I pray with the psalmist, O God, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. In respect to the fourth ideal, I cannot speak all I feel. It pains me greatly to see my lads deliberately choose the evil and scoff at the good. They seem to have no moral convictions on right and wrong, nor any high sense of service, not even a spirit of helpfulness to myself, their mother, or the home, let alone of service to humanity, with all their advantages for education. They are simply attracted by the tinsel and bright lights of the show and society, missing entirely the worthwhile associations and studies that would develop mental and moral strength. As yet, they are not outstanding characters. They are one of the crowd, really in the lower strata of the crowd. These are the things that make me blue. Some of them can be overcome, but at present I see no bright outlook. This is a bitter accounting. The returning joy and assurance Grandpa wrote about to Ronald almost a year ago was short-lived. His depression now is considerably deeper. In the explication of his first point, Grandpa's words about the home are shocking. He gives reasons. This is the only place where he says, we. He means Eunice when he speaks of failing health. Things have not improved with Grandma. She writes to Ronald in France, it is so hard for Dad to have me this way. He needs me so, but I am not much good till I get stronger. And Grandpa writes, I do not know when Mother will come home. I miss her greatly. Work is my only diversion. I do work like the dickens when she is away. And then unsatisfactory help. He writes Trevor shortly before his blue memo. Henry is not coming back to the farm. He is going into city business again. I feel very blue over my influence on the boys. And necessity of economy in order to meet obligations. The depression is not yet over, and repeatedly Grandpa's letters worry about money. I've had to buy a new cooler. I've had to take out another loan to tide me over. Grandma's illness costs money. So does hiring help to take her place. Grandpa speaks longingly of taking Grandma on vacations, where he too would get rest, but they are out of the question. But the last item, and especially the lack of interest on the part of our lads, that's the real kicker, particularly in view of Grandpa's severe and specific judgment of those lads in the explication of the fourth point. In the second point, he speaks of family restlessness and dissatisfaction with real life. In the third, he is despairing of his own spiritual life. But in the fourth, it pains me greatly to see my lads deliberately choose the evil and scoff at the good. They are out of the crowd, really in the lower strata of the crowd. But is that fair? Certainly not to Ronald, who by now is sending home increasingly mature letters from abroad. His college sins are old, and he has been serving humanity for the past 6 months. If bright lights are still attracting him, they are now the lights of the opera houses, the theaters, the art museums of Paris. But Trevor is only 50 miles from home and has tobacco on his breath. His mother writes, "I was so crushed in heart and spirit after you had gone, I thought I never could write. But you are my baby boy, in spite of what you have done, and I love you. But I want to be proud of you. I was so weighed down it seemed I could not get off my bed. To think you could make light of the things that mean so much to me, and that you could do the things you knew would break my heart and hurt a kind, loving father as you have. Can you trade a mother's love and a father's respect for things that are going to undermine your own character? Honor thy father and thy mother. I knew you were smoking for a long time. I knew why you would not let me kiss you. Along in middle of the summer I kissed you and smelled stale tobacco. And I knew then. I waited for you to tell, but you deceived me. And when I asked you, told me an untruth. You are naturally a fine boy, and have high ideals and good principles. But one sin leads to another, and it does not take long to slide downhill. I want to look in your eye and know it is as clear and true as it was 2 years ago. We used to be so near to each other. Don't let a nasty little devil of a cigarette separate you from your best love." And then both parents write Ronald about his brother Trevor's smoking and lying. But with the transatlantic time lag of 2 weeks each way, it is after Grandpa's memo to himself that he and Grandma receive Ronald's reply. "Your letter about Trevor came this morning. Of course, your worrying makes me feel rotten, because I know how badly you feel. Trevor's case so parallels mine that I can see both sides of it. My thought about it won't be a great deal of comfort to you, but I think it's pretty level. Here it is for what it's worth. Smoking in itself isn't a crime for which a fellow will be eternally damned. It is the thinking it is so bad that makes it so. I admit that it's injurious to health, but I don't think any more so than a dozen other indulgences that are not so heartily condemned. None of these things need to become habits. Neither does a little smoking need to lead to a harmful excess. I think you and Dad are stressing the evil of smoking so much that you're making it the chief fault a man can have. It isn't, and it doesn't need to lead to other faults. Even if Trevor should continue, the matter will more or less settle itself, for he worships his body, and when smoking interferes with his chances in athletics, smoking will go. It is hard to make a kid think it morally wrong when he sees good and great men all around him indulging, though, isn't it? His deceiving you about it is more or less natural, although it hurts. He is too weak to hurt you outright. And when he slips up, while he doesn't think he is committing a crime, he knows you will think so, and attempts to hide it. Smoking isn't the great crime. A man can think straight, love, and be true to his friends, and lead a life without violating friendship and honor, and still smoke. Oh, gee, I so want to express myself, make you feel better about it, and my words don't come well. This is my point. Because smoking is a tangible thing that can be nailed down. Don't you think you're making too much of it? It's much more to the point that he realizes he should deal seriously with his friends, that he should develop a high code of honor, that he should get enough sleep to keep him alert, that he should take any definite stand about this other question. Perhaps by making him think you think he is headed for a bad life by smoking as he has a bit, you really do make him think so, and that is bad. As to other things, Trevor has the right stuff and the right background. Don't bother about him too much. He's off on a 19-year-old tangent, just as I was a year or two ago, with its attendant questioning of everything, its tendency to coarse language and all. Sometimes I think 19 is a fellow's oldest period. He knows everything. After a bit, he comes to and loses his high horse. But I'm really worried about you both. Please don't think so hard about these things. Know you have three pretty decent kids who are surely profiting by your teaching, even when they seem to be the least. So, the trigger cause of the blue memo comes clear. Trevor's smoking and deceit. This against a background of Ronald's remembered shortcomings, plus farm worries, help worries, money worries, concern about Grandma. There's plenty here to make Grandpa blue, to cause him to take up his pencil and assess his life. He doesn't know it yet, but in regard to his sons, it's the darkness before the dawn. In his next letter to Trevor, he gives advice and encouragement on Trevor's upcoming exams, then goes on to outline a talk on problems of dairying he's soon to give in Iowa. About the last point, problems of recruiting dairymen, he says, I am going to hold out my ideas of the opportunities in the broader field of dairy work, such as not just actually milking cows, but research work, teaching, marketing, and so forth. And he adds, you know I am to speak at a big state meet in Illinois in February. I shall use this same thought. And at that Illinois talk, someone takes down the speech verbatim, as well as the question and answer period. Throughout the speech, Grandpa counters gloom. In the last section, he states that farmers, by their own gloom, are discouraging those in their sphere of influence from going into farming, including their own children. And he concludes the speech by saying, yes, there are problems in dairying, but there is no cause for despair. One of the questioners asks, I would like to hear what this gentleman has to say about keeping the boys and girls on the farm. That is more of a problem than getting a good sire. And he answers, I do not know. And there's laughter. I have two boys. I have talked the higher ideals and tried to give them a vision of their opportunity. I thought that they were absolutely against the farm. One boy has a position in community work in France at present. His last letter was to this effect. I am thinking more and more about the farm. And the picture and vision of the farm. He said, some people would call it kiddish, but I call it a vision. If he works that out, he will be a farmer. He will be a progressive farmer. The other boy is telling that he is getting to think better of the agricultural course that he is taking in Madison. I don't know whether they will be farmers. We do not care, especially whether our boys are farmers or not. This is the thing we hold up to them. First, be good and strong men and women. Then, choose the vocation in which you can serve humanity. We figure out the education to that effect. I believe the farm is going to appeal to them. There will be future discouragements in Grandpa's life, future major crises, but so far as anyone knows, he never writes another memo that so questions his own spirit or so despairs of his sons. Jackie's personal experience in the 20 years that she knows him is of the beautiful optimism Grandma writes about. To Jackie, Grandpa is, in the words of a famous writer, the apple tree, the singing, and the gold.